The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from Merritt, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
And good evening, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk 1240 on this Sunday, November 25th, 2018. Broadcasting live from the studios at WGBB 1240 AM and 95.9 FM. Here in beautiful downtown Merrick, New York, Gary Harding with you. John Panarese is on the air calling in live from Buffalo, New York. And we have a special guest in the studio that's going to be with us for the whole 2 hours. Gentleman, his name is Nick Hershon, and on Saturday, his book is going live. The book is entitled We Want Fish Sticks, and no Ranger fans, we really don't, but sorry, that's the name of the book. The bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders. Nick, thank you for coming in and hanging out with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Gary. Thanks a lot.
And John, how are you tonight up in beautiful downtown Buffalo?
Staying warm.
Staying warm?
Staying warm, yep.
How'd the Bills do today?
They actually pulled it out, unlike the Giants who blew it.
Yeah, unlike the Jets that blew it too. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
So you've been. I hear you're not allowed to leave the area since the hockey team up there has won nine in a row since you've been there.
That's what I'm told, that I'm not allowed to actually go home until the Sabres lose a game. So mm-hmm. I don't know what to tell you.
No. Well, listen, we appreciate you you hanging out with us and covering the interview here. So. So, Nick, we've known each other a few years, and I know you were actually on Sports Talk 1240 in January when the book was being, ready to be in its stages. So why don't you just start by telling everybody just how the idea came about?
Well, I've been an Islanders fan since 1999. I became a fan of the team in some of their worst when Mats Lindgren and Tim Connolly and Felix Podfit and Mariusz Czerkawski were the players.
You mean the stars?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All those stars players.
Quote, unquote.
But I really just fell in love with this team as being this small market underdog going up against the Rangers in the big city. And I started seeing people wearing the fisherman jerseys at the games at Nassau Coliseum. And I just wondered what was the story behind it. And being curious, I always had that in the back of my mind. Never really did much with it. Then when I was in grad school, I wrote an article for the Hockey News about the fisherman jerseys and started to, again, keep thinking, I want to do something with this someday. And then when I was in my PhD program, because I'm a journalism professor, and I wanted to, I had to do a manuscript that was going to become my doctoral dissertation. So I wanted to do something that would be really fun for me, that would be a story that I'd be passionate about and be able to interview a bunch of hockey players and executives and give context to what happened with this fisherman logo. So in 2016, I defended my doctoral dissertation at Ohio University, the Scripps School of Journalism, about the New York Islanders. Probably the first time that fish sticks ever appeared in the title of a doctoral dissertation anywhere. Then I ended up pitching it to University of Nebraska Press as a book, and here we are. So this book comes out on December 1st.
Right, and for those of you looking, obviously, University of Nebraska Press is a place. I've seen it on Amazon. Obviously, it's going to be in all the markets. And for those of you that have the webcam that are seeing us live, you're noticing that both Nick and I are proudly supporting our fisherman jerseys. Nick has the white home version of Wendell Clark, and I have the road version of Wendell Clark.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he doesn't have the A on it. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. I'm really jealous here. This was a purchase back in, I think it was 99. I went to a Modell's in Lake Success, and they were selling them for $5 or $10. I don't remember.
And they it really looks good, John, too, by the way.
There was a whole rack of them, and now I look back, and there probably were other players, too, and I didn't know any of the guys. I just was like, oh, it's so cool to get an Islanders jersey for so cheap.
Well, I actually spent, at the time in 1996, probably about $225 on it. Because this is a game, this mine's a game worn. Game weight, I mean.
Oh, wow.
So it's got the fighting strap on, it's got the whole thing. I actually, nobody could do the numbering right, so I actually went to a place up in Winnipeg that I ordered the jersey from. So, and they really didn't necessarily do the numbers on the sleeves right, because they're not really as waved, but the back is, and everything else looks good, so.
Yeah.
So, like I said, you know, nobody's probably ever had the word fish sticks in their books. So what was, obviously, this has been a long labor of love. So what got the process started? I mean, You know, who did you start talking to? Like you said, was players the first option to go to and get their opinions and things like that? And then obviously the story of the whole situation from, you know, the logo to the coaches to Spano and to all that other wonderful stuff. And we're gonna talk about this over the next hour. So, you know, just how about a little bit of a just, you know, how the process worked.
Yeah, so before I became an academic, I was a reporter. I was a reporter for 6 years for the New York Daily News, and then I freelanced for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the Hockey News, as I mentioned. So I kind of took a reporter's approach to this. I want to get every possible source that I could, whether that was interviewing the players, obviously, and I think there's 23 players that I ended up interviewing who wore the Fisherman logo, but the coaches, the executives with the team, the designers who actually created the logo, that thought that would be an interesting set of people.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. Yeah. That's a great little piece of the book.
And then the guys who played the mascot, the attorney who submitted the copyright form for the Fisherman logo, the trademark form. So I just really want to do the oral history interviews in that way, get everybody who could have an opinion there, broadcasters of the team, but then also doing archival research, going back to, I read every single issue of Newsday from 1995 to 1997, looking at the New York Times, the Post, every paper, the Daily News, obviously my former employer, going to the MSG archives, getting the old broadcasts, looking on YouTube, anything that people have published. Islanders fans were gracious enough. They sent me game programs. I went on eBay and I bought anything that had a Fisherman logo on it. So I really wanted to be as extensive as I could. I didn't want to leave any stone unturned.
Could you imagine, John, what his basement looks like right now?
Yeah.
Fisherman logo stuff everywhere.
Go ahead, John.
Worse than mine.
Yeah, so obviously I think a lot of people, especially the younger crowd, really don't know all the things that went into it. And it was really a learning lesson for me because, I mean, you did hear about the fact that the people that, in this case, that created the actual logo or created the mascot, created Niles, and that were involved in some very strong uniform creations in the past.
Right. So the company that created the Fisherman logo is named SME, Sean Michael Edward, and it was co-founded by a guy named Ed O'Hara, who I interviewed for the book. And yes, it's a very successful branding firm. So you might think, oh, they're associated with this colossal sports branding failure. Maybe we've never heard of them again. But they were very successful before and after the Fisherman logo mm-hmm. came out. And that's one of the reasons why the Islanders hooked up with them. The NHL actually recommended they go to this branding firm. And SME did the Toronto Raptors logo. They did the Florida Panthers logo. The
original
pouncing.
One. That yeah. was. I mean, it's a great looking uniform.
Yeah, and which came out not long before, the Islanders were thinking about rebranding. And so there was lots of successes that they've had, and they've since gone on to do every major sport, tons of jerseys in the NHL and the NBA, the World Series, et cetera. And the same firm that designed the logo did Niles, the mascot. So this is the one blemish on a remarkable run that they've had, and I was very appreciative that Ed O'Hara at SME and Pat McDarby, who is actually the guy who submitted the design for Niles, who has since passed away since I interviewed him, but that they were willing to give me the time to talk about this and know that I wasn't trying to critique them. I was really just trying to understand what happened and give that context to the Islander fan that maybe doesn't really know that.
What I, for me personally, I got to thank you because this was a very nostalgic book for me, bringing me back to a time when my brothers and I were season ticket holders and in the middle of all this. And when you're a fan, you don't know any of this stuff that's going on in the background. You know, what's the story behind this? Why in the world did they want to change the logo at that point? And what I thought was really neat was how you kind of explained that the Islanders were not the first team to do a completely rebranding like that. And, right. and you started it off by talking about the Kings and when Gretzky got traded over there and how they changed and how all these different teams, kind of followed suit. And I didn't know that or appreciate that as a fan back in, 95, 96. I was just one of those outraged people like, what the heck are you doing?
Sure.
So, why don't you explain a little bit of that, too?
Yeah, I mean, so as you say, early on in the book, I'm discussing in 1988 when Wayne Gretzky goes from the Edmonton Oilers to the LA Kings, and now you have the world's greatest hockey player playing for an American team, and not only an American team, but in the second largest media market in the United States after New York, right in L.A. And the Kings decide this is a perfect time for us to rebrand. Let's unveil new uniforms. And when Gretzky first comes out, he's wearing that silver and black uniform for the first time of the L.A. Kings. And I think for the first time across sports, there was a realization that a jersey isn't just a souvenir that you buy when you go to the game, and you don't necessarily have to even be a fan of the team. Plenty of people who probably hadn't even watched a hockey game ever in their lives decided they're going to wear a Wayne Gretzky jersey just because it's a fashionable thing to do. He's well known. He transcends hockey. He's just a part of pop culture. And so the Gretzky jersey thing really opens a lot of eyes in the NHL. Then shortly after that, you have the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim coming out, and before they've played a single game, they are the top-selling jersey in hockey. So it shows that you can make money even when you're not playing or if you're losing, because certainly the Ducks had some lean years at the beginning. And the San Jose Sharks come out with their cartoon shark biting through the hockey stick. And those color schemes that those teams are using, you know, because there's teal in the San Jose Sharks uniform, the idea of using a cartoon the way the Sharks and the Ducks did, that inspires the Islanders of maybe this is a way that we can make a little bit extra money, especially as a small market team. We're located in the New York market, but we're not getting the media attention that the Rangers do. We can't afford upgrades to our arena at Nassau Coliseum. We can't afford to buy the sort of elite players that people will pay money to watch. So maybe if we create a new jersey, fans will buy it. And that's how it all got started.
And, you know, it's really interesting that with the I'm just looking at the book right now, and it was on the camera, have the webcam on. You can actually see we got the book in prime display. I didn't realize, and it didn't dawn on me. And again, I've been a season ticket holder since from 89, and I didn't realize that in that season before that Niles was coming into play. I didn't even notice it at all. I didn't even pay attention, truthfully. And that really that kind of gave me like an interesting thought. If they were trying to brand that beforehand, and I'll just add another story, because you mentioned the fact that the Daily News, when it came out, that they put a picture of Dennis Potvin with his arms up in the air with an Islander jersey, but taking the old logo out and superimposing that new Islanders logo on. And I'll tell you a story. I was actually in Foxwoods, Connecticut at the time, and I took my mother there because she was a big bingo player. So we wanted to go. We took a trip out there so she can go gamble and play bingo. And I had the paper with me the whole time. I didn't look at it the whole trip. And we get up there, and we're sitting down, and she's getting her bingo cards ready, and I open up the paper, and I literally see that logo, and I take the paper and I chuck it in the air. I was like, you have got to be kidding me. You know, and that was obviously the perception that came about, and obviously a lot of people didn't like it. I got to learn to like it as I'm wearing my jersey now. But the thing I wanted to add on, and obviously it's not in the book, but the strange thing that has come about with this, that 20 years later, after that jersey was no longer worn by any player, that it's got popular again. Mm-hmm. And it got popular so quick by the millennial fans. I mean, did you get any rhyme or reason in your research into that as far as to the younger crowd starting to really grab a hold of it?
Well, I think to the point we were talking about earlier with SME being a top-notch branding firm, they knew what they were doing. Now, Ed O'Hara will tell you that when they submitted what they call a bucket, a whole different list of potential logos to the Islanders, they thought there were other logos that were preferable, and the Islanders, for whatever reason, picked up on the Fishermen. That said, it was still designed by an elite sports branding firm. If you look at the logo itself, yeah, it has the similarity of the Gorton's Fisherman from the seafood brand. But besides that...
Or Stan Fischler on acid.
Stan Fischler, Jake's McDonald people say, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think there are just some elements of the logo that work. And for... You know, the logo was really undone by how terrible the Islanders were at the period, and not just bad on the ice, right? But Mike Milbury making headlines as the coach and general manager for all the wrong reasons.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, yeah. And then later on, as I'm sure we'll also talk about, John Spano becoming the owner of the team. Mm-hmm. Becoming outed as a con artist who didn't have the money to really run the team. So there were so many other things that were happening that this logo got a bad rep just because of that.
Right. And, had the Islanders been a somewhat successful team, that they had the run that the Rangers had in 94, that they went to the Cup and then decided to rebrand at that time, would the logo have been more successful?
Right. And in a lot of the news reports of the time.
I'm sorry, John?
I think it would have been, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, in the news reports of the time, there's a lot of reporters saying it doesn't matter if they wear pink, it doesn't matter if Travis Green is wearing a toga, I remember that line in particular, people will just gravitate towards the team and towards whatever they're wearing as long as they're winning. So I think what you're seeing now, just to, you know, work full circle to your point, is that there's a lot of fans like me who grew up after the Fisherman logo was in play. They just look at it as some sort of nostalgic look back. Maybe there are some people who actually were around in that period, and believe it or not, there are some good associations with that logo. I mean, maybe it's when you first fell in love with the team or hockey in general. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have specific memories of some of the players like Ziggy Palfy, who was a great star for the Islanders, and the starts of the careers of a lot of guys who were, you know, good on that team. Tommy Salo wore the Fisherman logo and all of that. So I think it's now that we have some distance between us, there's a little bit of a look of, you know, we've only really had two logos in our history, if you don't count the Stadium Series jerseys and these kinds of pulling the NY off the original Islanders logo. It's kind of nice to have the, you know, something else that evokes the 90s.
And another thing I didn't know about at the time until I read the book was that a lot of the basis of the Fisherman, there's another story to that too, and you may want to just expound on that a little bit.
Sure. So when the Islanders are deciding that they want to rebrand and they want to get a new mascot, a new logo, one of the things that they were considering is they had just lost to the Rangers in the 1994 playoffs when the Rangers were on their way to winning their first Stanley Cup in 54 years. And for years, of course, the Islanders fans used to taunt the Rangers fans with chants of 1940, referring to the last year that the Rangers had won the Stanley Cup. But then when the Rangers win, and not only win, but on their way, they're steamrolling over the league, and they sweep the Islanders in the playoffs, right?
I remember that all too well. I was at those 2 games.
John, we could see the blue flames coming out of your nose right now in Buffalo. So.
And so not only do they sweep them, but none of the games are close. The Islanders are outscored in that series 22-3. Stan Fischler calls it the tennis series.
Yeah,
because
a great line.
Yeah, the scores of the games are like 6-0, 6-0, 5-1, 5-2, or something like that. So the Islanders are starting to think, what can we do to differentiate ourselves from our main rival in the market, the Rangers? And one way to do that is think, well, what is a depiction of Long Island that is different than New York City? And they start gravitating towards seafaring sorts of images. So one of the things that they start discussing also is Billy Joel, who is an iconic Long Islander and somebody who not only is known from being from Long Island, but in his songs, he's singing about Long Island. He has played so many concerts at Nassau Coliseum, the Islanders Arena. One way of picking up on his celebrity status, his fame, is he had just come out with a song a few years earlier called Downeaster Alexa that was all about the struggles of baymen, fishermen on the east end of Long Island when he was growing up, and their way of life kind of going out. There was all these new state laws, regulations that were restricting what kind of fish they could catch. And anyway, Billy Joel was singing about that, and a music video came out for Downeaster Alexa in 1990 that shows all of these gruff bearded older fishermen. And if you watch it on YouTube, you'll see, that's kind
and
of
the
inspiration.
There's that great lyric in the end of the song, "There ain't no island left for islanders like me."
Exactly. He actually mentions the word islanders at the end of the song. And so the Islanders are thinking about all of these different sorts of things. First of all, they're dreaming about the way that Jack Nicholson sits courtside to root on the Lakers, or Spike Lee roots on the Knicks. We could have Billy Joel sitting against the glass at Nassau Coliseum, you know, pounding his palms against the glass as Ziggy Palfy scoring a goal. Wouldn't this be amazing? That ends up not materializing. They invite Billy Joel to be part of the press conference when they unveil the logo in the summer of 1995, and he politely declines. So they never really get him on board. At the press conference, though, to unveil the logo, they do get the East Hampton Baymen's Association, and some of those same guys who were in that music video appear to help unveil the logo, and one of the members, Dan King, is a guy who looks very much like the Fisherman logo, because he has that Amish style full beard. And yeah, so there was some way here of trying to connect to the whatever the Long Island identity is, and that's a part of this book too. Is, you know, Long Island, I think, is a beautiful place. It's a place where I would love to live. It's clean, it's safe, but when you ask people from other areas, what is your one picture of what Long Island is? They struggle to come up with something.
There's no identity.
Right. As opposed to when you go to Philadelphia, the Liberty Bell. You know, there's so many different places, or with the Florida Panthers, you immediately think Florida, okay, sunshine and beaches, and, you know, there's a lots of immediate imagery. And, of course, with New York City, it's limitless. They have the Lady Liberty jerseys with the Statue of Liberty for the Rangers, and Times Square and Wall Street and everything.
Now, I'm jokingly saying this, but there was a rumor there was going to be a woman with a shopping bag.
Well, there's a joke that I include this story in the book where some of the Islanders executives are going around the table, and one of them jokes that the truest depiction of Long Island is a woman walking out of Bloomingdale's with a shopping bag into a Lexus.
Yeah.
And they have all these other jokes about, well,
he's not far off.
And maybe a traffic jam is the depiction of Long Island, or, you know, and again, I kind of understand what they're saying. There's also different parts of Long Island, right? We associate it maybe with the beaches, but there's also suburban Long Island. There's also the Hamptons and the Great Gatsby connection, and there's Teddy Roosevelt and Sagamore Hill, and there's all these different things, but they don't make one cohesive whole. There's not like one thing that people immediately associate with Long Island, and that was part of what undid this rebrand.
And no, don't think of Amy Fisher either, John.
I wasn't going to say that.
Yeah. but again, it's just very weird that, you know, and again, going back to the other point I made before, it's just so weird that in 2015, you know, that the kids are getting into it. And again, I think it's a great testament to the fact that, you know, they made this attempt. It didn't work. You know, they immediately, 2 years after, put the old Islander crest back on the wave jersey and kept that for 2 years until, I think it was 99, when they went back to the darker blue and put the four stripes on the shoulders and changed everything completely. But it's just a great testament to what the idea was, that, you know, that all this time later, that the kids are gravitating to it. I mean, they used the Fisherman jersey as a group sales gimmick. You know, you brought, you know, 10 people to a game, they all got Islander Fisherman jersey. Obviously, they're not, you know, they're a chintzier, cheaper version of it. But still, the idea is that logo's still getting out there.
Right.
You know, obviously, as opposed to, as you mentioned in the book, the Burger King jersey with L.A. that they tried, the third jersey, the Anaheim, dark wing duck on steroids.
Yeah, the
you
wild
know, some of those third
jersey.
Wing, you know, those, and to me, the other, the worst one I always thought, and I was a closet Vancouver fan in the 80s, was the old black and gold V jersey that they wore when they played the Islanders in the finals in 82. That was like one of the worst jerseys I've ever saw in my life, you know. But those don't seem to resurface, but the Fisherman jersey still lives. And that's the testament to the effort and the work. Obviously, we didn't see it really, the benefits, for two decades, but
yeah. And if you look at, because there's a point that I make late in the book about, okay, is this definitively the worst sports jersey of all time, or the worst sports branding failure of all time? And one of the points I come back to is a lot of the jerseys that you mentioned, the Wild Wing jersey, the Burger King jersey, they weren't the main jersey of the team. They were maybe a third jersey, or they were worn for a very short period of time.
Yeah, Vancouver, I think, wore this for about 4 or 5 years.
So this was the Islanders' main logo for, in 95, 96, that was the only jersey that they wore. Mm-hmm. In 96, 97, it's their, still their main logo, and then for 15 games they're wearing some sort of combination where you have the original Islanders logo against the background of the Fisherman jersey, so with the lighthouse patches and the waves and all that. But it is the main way of signifying this franchise. There's that departure from tradition. So with the LA Kings, when they rebranded in 88, they didn't have much of a history for fans to be attached to. The Islanders were in a very unique position. They are not an original six franchise, so they don't have the sort of history that's associated with the Rangers logo or the Red Wings or the Blackhawks logo, etc. And yet, because they won four straight Stanley Cups in the early 80s, they became this dynastic legendary American team, and people have such an affinity for that jersey and the Hall of Fame players who wore it. And you think of Mike Bossy and Bob Nystrom and Billy Smith, and the list goes on and on. So that's, I think, what makes this such a tragic rebranding, and why I argue it is the worst sports branding mm-hmm. failure. They just really didn't correctly evaluate fans' love for that logo.
And, you know, going back to L.A. when you were talking about with Gretzky, you know, for obviously for the 20 years before that, Jack Kent Cook, who owned the L.A. Kings and the L.A. Lakers at the time before Jerry Buss took it over, you know, he was a regal guy. So, you know, his teams were purple and gold, and that was the big thing. And I know, you know, they had a small piece of, you know, history, you know, when they had the Miracle of Manchester in 81 and, you know, stuff like that. And I know people, when Gretzky came, you know, they were as adamant as Islander fans were, you know, in the beginning, you know, oh, just because it's Wayne Gretzky, you know, they're making the change or whatever. You know, purple and gold was our identity, it was our thing. But, you know, unfortunately, it took a guy like him to turn people's heads around, and instantly it changed. And, you know, the silver and black was not only obviously big, you know, like you said, a big fashion statement or whatever, but the rap videos, the rap artists and stuff were starting to use the hockey jersey as a big thing.
Exactly.
You know, I remember seeing a, you know, believe it or not, a Springfield Indians jersey when the Islanders had that, that one year where Springfield wore these sheen type jerseys. You know, it was a whole different thing. And the guy was wearing wearing it in a rap video. And I'm like, wow. You know, I was like, this is the way, you know, this industry is going. So it just goes to show that, you know, it wasn't even one of the more successful ones wasn't necessarily met with a lot of positivity in the beginning.
Right. Yeah, and I think if the Islanders had the ability to buy a great player to accompany the rebrand, then this might have been a different story, right? But they just didn't have that kind of money. They struck out when they got some guys who they thought could be those standard bearers for the brand, but it was Mike Milbury as the coach who didn't really work out. And then there was, of course, Kirk Muller.
All right. Well, you know what? You know what, Nick? We're going to get to that. We're going to actually take a break right now. But when we get back, John and Nick and I, we're going to talk about the other part of the book, which obviously deals with the saga known as Mike Milbury, and obviously the saga of the Islander ownership, because that's just as much a part of this book as the jersey is. So we're going to come back and take a couple breaks, and Nick Hirschstein will be hanging out with us for the whole 2 hours of Sports Talk 1240 tonight. But when we come back, we'll get into the Islander ownership and management situation. Gary Harding, John Panarese, and Nick Hirschstein on Sports Talk 1240. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now back to the show.
Okay, Gary Harding, John Panarese, and Nick Hirshhorn with you on Sports Talk 1240 tonight, and we're going to continue discussing We Want Fish Sticks, the bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders. So the first half hour, we talked about that lovely little uniform that Niles wears and that Nick and I are sporting right now. But that wasn't the only thing that was going on for fans of the New York Islanders. Right, John?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of drama in the background and in management. And I forgot that Don Maloney was the original, you know, was initially the general manager. And then we got good old Mad Mike Milbury after that.
Exactly. And I mean,
all,
you know.
And all of the stuff that happened, you know, with the players just really, it just typified all of the problems the Islanders were having.
I mean, just give a little history for those that are listening that may not really remember a lot of it. You know, again, it was the beginning of my relationship with my wife in 1993, and it was great times. I mean, you know, the run to the Stanley Cup semifinals, you know, the defeat of the Pittsburgh Penguins on the Ray Ferraro goal. You know, it was great being an Islander fan at the time, you know, and you think, oh, 1994 is coming. You know, you got a team a year older, a year wiser, a year stronger. You know, Al Arbaugh behind the bench. You know, what could go wrong? And unfortunately, to me, and I still say it was the biggest mistake that the Islanders made, and this was Don Maloney as the general manager, that they didn't hold on to Glenn Healy. Glenn Healy, people that know me for the last 30 years know I'm a big Glenn Healy fan. Always was, always will be. But basically, when he went to four teams in a matter of one day and then ended up going to the Rangers, that was the move that beginning to spell the end, because they had to go get a goaltender. Mark Fitzpatrick was not your number one. They go get Ron Hextall, and we all know what happened that year in 94 with Hextall, and, of course, losing to the Rangers and in the tennis final, to, you know, and the Rangers run to the Cup. And then, Nick, we'll let you talk about that a little bit, because obviously that's where the fun began for management.
Yeah, I mean, so I kind of view this rebrand as three phases, right? So in the spring of 1994, they lose to the Rangers, and then they start thinking first about, can we maybe introduce a mascot that will determine whether or not this rebrand will catch on, and that's the creation of Niles. But then they move on to, in the summer of 95, when they're going to officially unveil the fisherman jerseys, and they're hiring a new head coach. And Don Maloney is looking at all these different options that are out there, and the two main finalists for the job are Barry Melrose, who's an ESPN analyst at the time and who had coached the Kings, and then you have Mike Milbury, who had been a former Boston Bruins player and had coached them to the Stanley Cup final in 1990, had been their assistant general manager, and was at the time an ESPN analyst. And the Islanders, again, they're looking to make a splash. They don't have a ton of money to spend, but obviously, a good coach costs less than a good star player. So they end up, after a lot of pressure from the media, and that was one of the stunning things to me, to read Newsday, where there was a straightforward headline, Isles Need Milbury. And every day, there's Jim Smith, who was a columnist for Newsday, but some other people in the other papers who were constantly saying, this is the best coach on the market. If the Islanders want to come across as a legit non-Bush League team, they'll hire Mike Milbury. So they do that. They make him one of the best paid coaches in hockey. They give him a 5-year contract for $3.5 million. And they make him the standard bearer of this brand at the start, because a lot of the players are untested, unknown. So they, you know, try to get him in the fold, and immediately he angers the Islanders alumni by talking about how Islanders management hung on to some of them for too long, past their primes, and that's the why they ended up declining in the late 80s and the early 90s and so forth. He's, of course, then his unconventional tactics become apparent very quickly. He clashes with pretty much every player on the roster at different points. And there's a story in the book of actually we're wearing the Wendell Clark jerseys in studio, and there's a story in the book about him clashing with Wendell Clark to the point where Wendell Clark almost is going to fight him and has to be physically restrained because he's questioning Wendell Clark's commitment to the team at a time when Wendell was apparently dealing with a lot of health issues and had a bulky back and had missed lots of games due to injury, and he was going through regular acupuncture treatments and other things before games in order to to play for the Islanders, and Milbury's questioning, hey, how come you're sitting all the way at the end of the bench? Like, you don't want to get called out for a line change, or you, why don't you sit in the middle like a true leader? So Milbury is kind of the beginning of picking people to be the faces of the rebrand that really were bad choices.
John?
And it was, you know, what amazed me was just the interviews with, that you had with the players and just the stories. I mean, there was a one that really got me because Gary and I interviewed Mick Vokoda a while back, and how Milbury would tell him he's not playing. He's not playing today, and then Vokoda would go about his business like, oh, I guess I'm not going to be in the lineup. And at the last second, he would tell him, oh, you're playing.
Yeah, I mean,
he wouldn't be prepared, you know?
Yeah, I mean, apparently, and Mick Vokoda talked about this with lots of players, where Milbury had this strange tactic where I guess he thought it was going to motivate players, but he would tell a player if he knew that their parents were going to come to the game that night, oh, you're not going to dress for the game. As if, you know, he's taking it out against them, that their parents are going to be there, or maybe trying to light a fire under them. Like, if you want to perform in front of your parents, you better play better. But he would do that. And then the story that you're referring to, John, is where, Mick is told before the game by Milbury that you're not going to dress for this game. So Mick skips his usual routine before a game, and he doesn't take a nap. He eats pizza instead of loading up on carbs, and he stays at the Coliseum. And then Milbury comes up to him and says, well, you're actually going to dress for the game, but you're not going to play in it. So he's like, all right. So he gets on the bench. And then, like, a few shifts into the game, Milbury sends him out there. And he gets into a fight. And I think this is a game versus the Lightning. And he's, you know, they're playing some, like, real heavyweights. Gets into a fight, holds his own, comes out of the penalty box, gets dispatched again, next shift, and another big fight. And he comes back to the bench, and Milbury apparently tells him, according to Mick, you know, kid, you've got balls on you. You really, you know, I didn't tell you you were going to play in this game, and you really showed you could fight and everything. Do you think you have one more in there for me? And Mick is kind of stunned that he would invoke himself instead of the team. He says, well, I've got one more in me for the boys. You know, I can play for my teammates. And Milbury just walks away and smirks and doesn't play in the rest of the game, and their relationship is irretrievably damaged. And there's a lot of those sorts of stories of what Milbury would do that was just really zany stuff, and kind of startling that nobody would call him out on it, that there was no one higher up, and that's part of the absentee ownership they were going through at the time, who could say, like, cut this nonsense out. Like, you're not really helping these guys
he
develop.
He was like this totalitarian ruler, and again, because of the situation of ownership, he knew it, and he knew how to exploit it, and truthfully, he didn't care. I mean, you know, when you come out in your first press conference and say, screw the Rangers and screw the Devils, you know, I mean, that's telling you right there what kind of an attitude you got. And, you know, that may work up in Boston, but it doesn't work for this little market called Long Island.
Yeah, and there was a generational difference there too, right, because you have Milbury, who was the NHL of the 1970s, early 80s, of gritty kind of a player who wasn't scoring a lot of goals, wasn't making all-star teams, but he survived because of, you know, his penchant
for fighting. Because he could throw a shoe.
And that too. And, of course, you know, best known for climbing into the stands at a Rangers game at Madison Square Garden and beating a fan with his own shoe. And that video is always a fun one to watch. But that tells you something about, there were also all these warning signs, and I couldn't believe, again, looking at the media coverage, Newsday saying he is the clear pick, and all of these media outlets saying he's the guy, Don Cherry saying, you know, this is the guy the Islanders have to hire, and they're ignoring some of the stuff that went on.
Well, what did you get an idea of the relationship, say, that Milbury had with Don Maloney, who hired him?
Well, so, again, Newsday, Jim Smith and Newsday challenges Don Maloney and says, you don't have the guts, and that's the term he used, you don't have the guts to hire Mike Milbury because you know he might someday be your replacement as general manager. And Maloney, I think to his credit, decides that probably what's best for the team at the time is to get somebody like Milbury involved, and Milbury had a reputation for being strict. Maybe this is what this young untested Islanders team needs, is somebody who's really going to crack the whip on them. And he has experience. You know, he had taken the Bruins to the Cup final just 5 years earlier. So, you know, Maloney, to his credit, does that. It's kind of unclear what their relationship is like. And it's also interesting to me that you know, Maloney gets fired only a few months into the 95-96 season, and he's very quickly replaced by Mike Milbury as coach and general manager. And so I kind of write this line in the book, like, so the same coach whose team performed so poorly that he got the general manager fired is then the new general manager, too?
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear that the Islanders just want to save money. And Milbury became their top choice because he agreed to not get a bump on his coach's salary. He would take on the dual roles of coach and general manager for the same money that he had been making. And that seems to be good enough.
And again, that brings you another step into it, and then seeing that obviously the management situation, and obviously that started with Pickett, and then Pickett releasing the team to, you know, then we'll go over the Gang of Four, and then the other group. So there was no stability there, and obviously, you know, this organization was not making any money whatsoever. They were losing money hand over fist, and obviously it was a good thing that they had the MSG contract, or, you know, we all know from the last 20 years that this team may not be here as a result of that.
Yeah, and well, that's another part of this narrative, is that it's easy for us to dismiss the Fisherman logo today and look at it and what were they thinking, right? But in reality, in the mid-90s NHL, Long Island was lucky just to have a team at all. And there were so many guys here, whether it was ownership, certainly the players, you know, they were just fighting to keep a team alive where it didn't belong anymore. Small market teams just weren't working out. The Fisherman jersey was one step to try to at least infuse money into the team. Maybe if people buy a bunch of jerseys, there's some excitement. You were invoking earlier the idea of rappers wearing the Fisherman jersey, maybe an MTV music video or something. And so even if people have never been to Long Island, don't follow hockey, but they're wearing it just because they think it looks cool. It's at least the team stayed on Long Island through all of this. But there was that disconnect, and Brett Pickett, who is the son of John Pickett, the Islanders owner at the time, you know, I interviewed him for the book, and he was saying, you know, he would watch the footage of some of these fans protesting outside the Long Island Marriott or outside Nassau Coliseum, and he'd think, if only they knew, like, that we are struggling just to keep the team here. Like, we are trying as much as we can. And I get it from a fan standpoint, too, because they had fallen so far from the dynasty years, and if you're paying good money to go to an Islanders game, you want to see a good product. But I think there was that disconnect, and I certainly, through doing the research for the book, gained an appreciation for the ownership. Even if it was misguided, I think they were trying to do something that would keep the team on Long Island.
And it was just interesting when one of the things you wrote in the book is that you said, you know, the guys from the Gang of Four, then Gluckster and Milstein and David Seldon, and then obviously John Spano going into the play. You had three sets of ownership, and inside each one of those owners, there was somebody getting convicted of something. You know, it's just like, how lucky can this organization get to get people that are running it, you know, either get in, you know, financial trouble or don't even have finances at all, and when, you know, getting into the John Spano situation. And that, you know, that obviously that became a big story of its own, and, you know, just another tick on the bad luck of the Islander organization, the Islander franchise.
Yeah, Tom Croak, who was the head of the Save the Islanders Coalition,
yep.
Later became Support the Islanders Coalition, but he has a line in the book where, you know, he's saying, we lead the league in convicted felons.
Yeah.
And it is kind of funny that, you know, I know someone I saw was posting online about, I have a line in the book, you know, talking about that some of the Islanders owners, I tried to reach them for comment, but they did not return the letters sent to their correctional facilities. And it's true. I actually did send a few letters to correctional facilities, hoping that Stephen Walsh, who's actually the member of the Gang of Four ownership group, who's probably most responsible for the Fisherman logo itself. It seems mm-hmm. that he was the one advocating for it in meetings. You know, he's in prison. But
20 years, wasn't it?
I forget how long he's been.
Yeah, 20 years.
But yeah, I think that, you know, that's another part of this rebrand that makes it one of the worst sports branding failures, is that years later, you look back at where these guys end up, it's all just a shameful period for Islanders fans, you know, to have to deal with, you know, there's lots of teams that lose and that have historic runs of losses, and, mm-hmm. you know, the Chicago Cubs not winning the World Series for many years, and Boston Red Sox curse and all that. But this sort of series of things within a 28-month span, as I say in the book, you know, it's more than most franchises have to deal with in 28 years.
28 years.
And, you know, and your arena is leaking, and there's just, you know, the fans are taunting you with, we want fish sticks chants, and Kirk Muller is traded to the Islanders, supposed to be this star player who had won the Cup with the Montreal Canadiens, was their captain.
Yeah, let's talk about Mr. Muller.
Yeah.
Oh, John, here you go. Go ahead, John.
No, I just, I didn't know, you know, you, as a fan, again, you hear stories and you read stories about what the deal was with him. And, you know, realistically, he really didn't want to play here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the trade that was really Don Mahloney's undoing, right? Because he's supposed to usher in the start of the Fisherman era in 95-96 season. And, again, it seems just like the Milbury hiring in some ways seems to make some sense. Kirk Muller seems to make sense as a good leader for the Islanders. He had been the captain of a Stanley Cup winning team. He had played in New Jersey with the Devils, and, you know, so he's used to playing in this market. And just a guy known for being a very gutty player, you know, who would give his all for teammates. And yet, the Islanders trade for him in a trade that also brings them Matthew Schneider, the defenseman. And they trade away, you know, Pierre Turgeon, who had been their star player for a while, and Vladimir Malikov. But they trade for him at a time when, you know, it's easy to look back and say, well, that was a stupid trade because Turgeon goes on to be a great player for the Canadiens. Malikov has some early success. But Turgeon at the time seemed to be getting disenchanted with Long Island. He wasn't really performing. And Muller, you know, you think, okay, you get some new blood in here, some guy who's a veteran and can help all of these raw rookies and these new draft picks the Islanders are getting. And it's kind of infuriating because I describe in the book how one of the first things that Kirk Muller says is, you know, I'm a guy who shows up every night to play. And there's all of these lines that he keeps giving in interviews after he finally shows up in Long Island. But the truth is, for the first few games, he refuses to report to Long Island. Mm-hmm. And the Islanders are left in this very embarrassing position of Matthew Schneider came. How come Kirk Muller's still not here? And they should be showing off their prize new acquisition. Stan Fischler tells that story about he's waiting in the, you know, the Nassau Coliseum annals, and you have you know, Matthew Schneider coming out to be introduced to the press. Where's Kirk Muller? And then the Islanders are making excuses. Well, he has a passport issue. Well, he had some sort of business he needs
that
to
I
attend
remember.
To.
I remember the passport issue. So
yep.
Yeah.
There was a lot of back and forth. And you know, again, fans real. You know, fans are not that dumb. You know, I mean, they realize when, you know, when you're given that, you know, speak or whatever. I'm trying to think of the right word, but you know, you tell them a story, they're going to know you're telling them a story, and they're going to make you pay for it, and that's exactly what happened. And I like how you said that the only thing you ever saw that they made, you know, any kind of
the only mass-produced figurine
was a Kirk Muller, you know, starter kit figurine.
Yeah, starting line. So the only mass-produced figurine ever of an Islanders player in a fisherman jersey is Kirk Muller. And it's funny that, because I actually bought one online as part of my research process, and it comes in a package where it's him wearing the fisherman jersey, but it has a card of him with the Montreal Canadiens, and I think that's kind of ironic. The team he never really wanted to leave. And yeah, it's there were all these sorts of, you know, marketing blunders. But when you trade for a guy like that, you think he's really going to turn into a star, and maybe the fans will accept this logo. And even when they unveil the jersey, they kind of have a faux pas, because in June of 95, when they have this press conference that we talked about earlier, Kirk Muller comes, and so does Don Mahloney, and in the middle of what really should have been a day just to talk about how awesome this jersey is and how it's paying homage to the Long Island fishermen and so forth, the reporters go over to Muller and ask him about contract negotiations with the Islanders, and he says that he's in the process of renegotiating his contract because of the conversion between Canadian dollars and U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
And that's like a scoop that, you know, the reporters didn't expect to get. You know, it's a quiet summer on Long Island. They don't think they're going to get anything. So then all the reporters scramble over to Mahloney and ask him, are you renegotiating his contract? And Mahloney says, no, I'm not renegotiating his contract. I've told him that. He might think that that's going to come, but no. So you have a day that's supposed to be all positive, our brand new jersey, and meanwhile you have Kirk Muller and Don Mahloney at odds, and so of course that's going to be the story. So it's just one of the many sorts of, you know, mistakes, missteps that happened throughout this process.
You can change the word Islanders for Murphy. You know, it's like Murphy's Law. Anything that was going to happen,
yep.
You know, anything that could have screwed that organization up, they found a way to do it. And again, it was tough for us. You know, with John and I sitting in the stands. I mean, it was just there were so many horrible nights. You know, whether it was lack of player help or you know fights with the coaches and fights with the management. It just those 2 years were just complete hell. And then, like
it
I said,
was
then you get
it was torture.
And then you get the John Spano situation. I mean, you know, that's Hollywood. You couldn't make that stuff up. I mean, you know, everybody came out and said, "Oh, here comes the savior. Here comes the guy." And you know, when you look back at it, you just say, "How the heck did not only the Islanders, but the NHL? How did they not go deep enough and do a dive in to figure out this guy didn't have enough money to you know what in?"
Yeah, that is stunning. And I still think that if John Spano had turned out to be who he presented himself to be and pumped some money into the team, I say in the book, this could have been the beginning of a change with the Islanders. You might look back at it and say, well, that was a lousy jersey and there were some rough times, but this is when we got the owner who finally gave us stability, paid for a new arena, got us the great players. But instead what happens is the Islanders are so hungry. When John Spano comes onto the scene in the 96-97 season, they're so hungry for a savior. And Spano, there's you know all these newspaper reports that are basically claiming already that he owns the team, although he hadn't officially closed the deal with John Pickett yet. But the media jumps to the conclusion that he owns the team. The Islanders really do nothing to dissuade that sort of reporting. And as you're saying, Gary, it's kind of stunning that no one vetted this guy. So you have a guy who's not worth a fraction of what he says, and yet he's presenting himself as a high roller. No one asked questions. No one, like, asked for a bank account or some sort of official document to show that he's worth what he says he is.
He was robbing Peter to pay Paul and everything else in his business world, and he had nothing to show for it. And when he was supposed to be giving, what, $1.6 million or $16 million, he was sending a check for $16,000.
Right.
Or 7 million for 7,000, you know.
He'd play all these games about, you know, and making up all of these different reasons why he's delaying his money to John Pickett. And at one point, Pickett's attorney writes this letter and says, you know, he's blamed everything. He's blamed ravenous South Africans. He's blamed acts of God. Yeah. He's blamed, you know, a terrorist attack in London. And all of these things are somehow reasons why he cannot make his final payment to Pickett. And the reality is he just doesn't have the money to pay for the New York Islanders.
And the weird thing, you know, all this situation going on, the team actually did play better when Spano was on board. You know, it just, you know, the strange thing, you know, you thought, oh, there's positivity. And that positivity went all the way down into the locker room, and it seems like the guys played as good as they played in almost 3 years.
Yeah. Well, that's what's tragic about this story, too, right? Because if it was just from the very start there was no hope and they're losing in all of these, in these games, then, okay, you just kind of chalk it up to it was a rough season. But it becomes a little bit of a roller coaster, right? Especially when Spano comes in, because you think, finally, we have our savior. As you're saying, they start winning some games. Hey, we still got a lot of guys on the team who were on that miraculous 1993 team that beats the Penguins when they were this two-time defending Stanley Cup champs. We have a lot of guys on the team who were in the playoff series versus the Rangers. You know, they made the playoffs. And then, you know, we're getting you know, all this new blood. And they do have a stretch there where it looks like they might make the playoffs. And there's a point in late March of 97 where they trade for Robert Reichel.
Yep.
He goes on a line with Brian Smolinski and Ziggy Palfy.
And they go on a tear.
And it's unbelievable. I mean, in their first few games, you know, Reichel is having like 5 points a night. That line is just clicking in every way. And I think it's about a month before the season's going to end, and the Islanders are 1 point out of the playoffs.
Yep, I remember getting the playoff voucher. I'm like, you've got to be kidding. I would have never thought that in October of that year.
Right.
But then when everything going on and the team gets better, I'm like, wow, I'm actually going to actually pay for playoff tickets. This is great. And then, well, things happen.
And the wheels fall off. It's that's what makes it a shame, right, is because the fans were getting so excited, and like you're saying, it's starting to affect the players. And even if they had fallen short in 96-97, but Spano came to fruition in 97-98, and you start seeing some more positivity between players, but that's the undoing of all that. And then the news starts breaking that he doesn't really have the money that he says he has. And, of course, then eventually he's going to prison. You're seeing him being led in and out of courthouses and things. And it's just another embarrassment. I'm like, but this guy was supposed to be our savior. And he says, which I have as one of the chapters in the book, is called From Savior to Devil, because he says that that's what happened to him, is he went from being the savior. And you see the footage of people waving Spano for President signs at Nassau Coliseum and really thanking him so much. Clark Gillies goes onto the ice at a ceremony at Nassau Coliseum and says, you know, something like, I want to thank a man by the name of John Spano for bringing back.
The place erupts.
Yeah.
I remember that night, yep.
And so, you know, you have to be – it makes Islanders fans just so skeptical, right, of anybody. And I understand even today, you know, where you get a little bit skeptical of, like, whenever you hear about talk of a new arena at Belmont, or you hear talk about, well, this general manager is really going to work out, or this coach, or this player, you just start to think about some of these things. And I can understand why fans would be, okay, like, you know, Lou Lamoriello has a great track record. Barry Trotz has a great record.
Right.
But we've been down this before.
How many times has this organization been burned
at
the stake? You know, and it's a hard thing to deal with. John, you got anything more?
No, I just, like I said initially, I just think it's a great book. And, you know, whether you're a new Islander fan just coming onto the scene and you're young and you don't know the history and how, you know, what us long-term fans have been through, the turmoil and tragedy, or if you're like me who lived through it, you're really going to appreciate the stories in this book. And I can't believe some of the things you dug up. That's what was amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, I actually read it again yesterday. Sat around for a good 4 or 5 hours and reread it, and I'm like, all I'm doing is shaking my head, and my wife's looking at me like, what's the matter? I'm like, read this book. I said, you know what we went through. You know all the pain, and it brought everything back. But again, there's a lot of information, even for us that have been following the team as long as we have, that, you know, there's a lot of information that Nick spent countless hundreds of hours digging through, and it's really, it's appreciated. And we know that when this book comes out on Saturday, that it's going to be hopefully a good, successful book. I mean, it's a labor of love, obviously. You spent 3 years working on this thing, and I can't wait for everybody to read it. So, like I said, Nick's going to be with us for the second hour. John, we're going to have to let you go for a half hour, because we got another guest coming on. But you're going to come back at 9:30, and we'll talk about some other stuff. All right, man?
Okay, you got it.
All right, see you in a little bit.
Okay.
All right, so like I said, the book is We Want Fish Sticks, The Bizarre and Infamous Rebranding of the Islanders, from Nebraska, University of Nebraska Press. It's available in all the book outlets coming on Saturday. Nick's got a couple of signings. You got one, at Offside Tavern, I believe.
Yeah, I got my first signing is actually December 8th at the Glen Oaks Library in Queens. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to have one later in December at the Offside Tavern during a viewing party for the Islanders away game versus the Toronto Maple Leafs. I've got one coming up in January at Jerry Cosby, the hockey memorabilia store, a block away from Madison Square Garden before an Islanders-Rangers game. And then I'm going to have one toward the end of January at the East Hampton Library on Long Island. And all that information I'll put up on my Twitter account, at Nick Hirshon, N-I-C-K-H-I-R-S-H-O-N.
Yep, and we will definitely make sure we advertise as well on Sports Talk 1240. So we got 1 hour in the books. When we come back, we're going to change a little bit of gears, and we're going to talk to a gentleman by the name of Christian Arnold, who covers the Islanders for Islanders Insight as well as the AP. We're going to talk about the state of the current team as we hit the quarter pole. And then at 9:30, John will come back, and we'll talk about some other New York sports things. We don't really want to talk about the football teams, but we'll have to put a couple minutes to it. So 1 hour in the books, 1 hour to go. Nick Hirshon and Gary Harding here with you in the GB Studios in Merrick. We'll be back. Make sure you stay tuned.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.